Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on Monday, July 6th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, thanking the entire Saratoga community for the extra effort to follow all the necessary precautions to keep everyone safe. Saratoga Hospital, people you can trust, care you deserve. Joining us on the line today, two experts, virologist Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences and Dr. Eli Rosenberg of UAlbany's Department of Epidemiology. They are here to discuss the coronavirus and multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children associated with COVID-19. I expect a lot of calls. Call early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Yeager, Dr. Rosenberg, and your calls coming up on Medical Monday after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line today, two experts, Vox Pop regular over the past several months, virologist Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, and Dr. Eli Rosenberg of UAlbany's Department of Epidemiology. They are here to discuss the coronavirus and multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children associated with COVID-19. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Rosenberg has a PhD in epidemiology from Emory University Rollins School of Public Health. He teaches epidemiology and biostatistics at UAlbany. His research centers on public health challenges in HIV, STI, viral hepatitis, and Zika surveillance and prevention. If you have a question for these two experts, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We will answer a limited number of emails as well. You can try that if you want. VoxPop@WAMC.org. VoxPop@WAMC.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Yeager, Dr. Rosenberg, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you.
Nice to talk to you again, Ray.
Nice to have you here. And we'll start with you, Dr. Yeager, since you've been on the show multiple times since March. It looks like, whereas we thought we maybe had plateaued nationwide and things were on the downward slope, looks like things are now spiking again. And what do we know about this virus that we didn't know a month, 6 weeks ago, the last time you were here?
Well, first let me start by saying I hope you're doing well and your family's healthy and you enjoy the holiday. And I'm happy to join Dr. Rosenberg this afternoon. What we know is the virus is still pretty infectious and a lot of us still have to deal with the behavioral issues around this virus. So I think we're learning more about potentially diagnosis and treatment. And with the diagnosis, we're able to identify cases a bit more quickly than we could in the past. But it's still a problem because it still transmits very easily. And of course, what we've learned is that it is a virus that kind of exploits our behaviors. And if we kind of let our guard down for a little bit, we end up with situations in some of the states out west where it's kind of resurging.
Dr. Eli Rosenberg, I think this is the first time you've been on this program. I may be wrong about that. You did a study, or you were part of a study, mm-hmm. on multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children in New York. And, you know, one of the things that I've talked about with Eric on previous programs is the avalanche of information and misinformation and rumors and hyperbole and anecdotes that have come down since this virus hit our national consciousness. And one of the things that was talked about was this multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. You guys did a study about this. Tell us about it.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree that this is an unprecedented time in terms of the generation of new science and information and messages coming from all sorts of areas and levels. So in this study, this was an investigation launched by the New York State Department of Health in partnership with CDC, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and then us here in the UAlbany School of Public Health. And this was one of two large investigations that were published together at the New England Journal of Medicine. And we studied 99 children who had this condition, and through in-depth review of their charts. And what we found was that there's really quite a spectrum of symptoms and experiences that these hospitalized children had, ranging from gastrointestinal problems to heart problems and so forth. And we really found that it really affected children of all ages. Half were under 12, but half were over 12, about a third were over 12. And unfortunately, two of the children passed. And so it's a very serious condition, but I do think it's important to emphasize it's quite rare. So this is really a rare occurrence among children who are diagnosed with COVID-19. And for really the large majority of children who experience this infection and this virus, they won't suffer these consequences.
You know, I'm of course not a scientist. I work on the radio, but the conclusion to the report said there was a correlation in the spike of this multi-system inflammatory syndrome and the advent of this COVID-19 crisis. But does a correlation in time necessarily suggest a cause?
That's a very important point. Well, I'd say first piece is many of these children were actually also positive for either the virus itself or antibodies to the virus. So many of these children were in fact had experience with infection from the virus. That again does not necessarily prove everything. That's a very tight linkage. And the other thing that we're seeing is sort of this time linkage. So it seems to be that on average about and in cross settings, not just in New York where this is happening, there's a several weeks delay. In our study, it was a 31-day delay from when infections peaked in children to when we see these the syndrome appear as well. And that's consistent with this sort of secondary inflammatory response. Again, it's not a full proof, but this sort of time linkage is very consistently shown, as well as this diagnostic linkage.
We are joined today on this Medical Monday by virologist Dr. Eric Yeager and epidemiologist Dr. Eli Rosenberg. If you would like to get a question in, give us a call, 800-348-2551. And gentlemen, two quick emails, and then we'll take a quick break and then hit the phones. This one's from Mike in Richmond. Wants to know if you can provide the latest information on the potential for aerosol spread of COVID-19 or coronavirus without worrying about scaring us. It seems like the WHO, is somewhat reluctant to provide us with the full picture, and we want accurate information. And that's from Mike in Richmond.
So I can take a quick stab. So I think there's been a lot of studies out there that have looked at aerosol generation, but there hasn't been many studies that looked at aerosol plus infected patients. So certainly in a hospital setting with certain procedures like intubations that could generate aerosols, there's been some information. But in terms of outside the hospital, the ability of the virus to pass by aerosols has not been conclusively shown. It doesn't mean it's an impossibility. And I think that the hesitancy is to look for studies to really show and not to scare people needlessly. I mean, that it could be, but there could be a greater route through coughing and sneezing, another transmission route to an aerosol. And I think with that, if the studies come out, then we need to then take the next step to figure out how to prevent that. And I think that's probably maybe where some of the hesitation has been in having malls and gyms open up, because there's a chance for having these closed areas, and the virus spreads quite rapidly if there's a density of people and it's in a very tight location. So I think that's the concern, is that could aerosol become, may not be the main driver, but it is a possibility. And how can we deal with that in terms of preventing more infections?
Dr. Rosenberg, isn't that fairly easy to test, though?
I actually think it's quite tricky. And the evidence, to get the right evidence that this is an aerosol transmission versus what's been the predominant thinking that this is droplet-based, is very tricky. And really requires really detailed studies, to prove it quite definitively.
All right, I'll tell you what. We have one more email, but it is break time. We'll hit the email on the other side, and then we'll go to the phones. Dr. Eric Yeager and Dr. Eli Rosenberg here to answer your questions about coronavirus. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's a Medical Monday today. We're joined by Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences and Dr. Eli Rosenberg of UAlbany's Department of Epidemiology. This second email, and then back to the phones we go. This one's from Keith. I have Crohn's, which is an autoimmune disease, and have needed to take immunomodulators to lower my immune system to treat my disease for the past 15 years. Because of the medications that I take, I've not been able to take live virus vaccines or boosters like the MMR shot. What is the likelihood that the eventual vaccine would be a live virus vaccine that immune-compromised individuals will not be able to take? We are in one of the highest-risk populations for COVID-19, and that is from Keith.
So I think what we're fortunate is that there are a number of vaccines that are vaccine platforms are being tested, and many of those are non-live attenuated. So the worry of the live attenuated is that it is a virus that has been weakened to the point that it stimulates an immune response in most people. But there's a concern that in individuals like Keith that might have a compromised immune system, the virus could cause some ancillary damage. Most of the vaccines that are being tested right now are RNA-based, or in some cases an adenovirus, a weakened virus. So that's one of the vaccines that's been promising is the one out of Oxford, the adenovirus vaccine. But there are many others that are not a virus-based vaccine. They are either protein or RNA or DNA. So my feeling is that there will be multiple types of vaccines available, and really safety is paramount. We're kind of at this precipice between urgency and trying to do things in a safe manner. So we're trying to really expedite the Operation Warp Speed to expedite what takes normally decades into a matter of months. But with that, there's still testing being performed to make sure that all people getting the vaccine will be safe for them to get it.
Dr. Rosenberg.
I think Dr. Yeager just summarized that really well, that really it's about options and that the platforms that are based on viruses are just one approach. And there's been a lot of attention in recent days to an RNA vaccine, which was just mentioned on the NPR national story that you guys just ran. There was also discussion of an antibody-based approach. So I think we're really looking at multiple possibilities for vaccines, and hopefully there will be options for everybody.
We're joined today by Dr. Eli Rosenberg and Dr. Eric Yeager. If you want to call, give us a shout now, 800-348-2551. Elizabeth in Rockaway, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
There's been discussion about opening up the school system in September, and considering that there's a vaccine on the horizon, number one, and number two, that on the news that came on just after you introduced your program, there's discussion about how far somebody has to distance, whether it's droplets or whether it's aerosol. And also Dr. Yeager on a previous show talked about when he rode a bicycle, he felt that 6 feet wasn't enough and it needs to be three times that amount. So my question sort of is two parts. What's their opinion about returning to schools in terms of the teachers who 25% are over 50 and are high risk for different reasons, and also some of the children, although supposedly it's a low incidence? Just what's the overall feeling of bringing children back to school in September and the teachers?
Okay, let's go to Dr. Rosenberg first and then Dr. Yeager.
Sure. So that's a great question. The schools have really received a ton of attention this past week. I'm sure the caller and others have heard of the American Academy of Pediatrics coming out with their statements pretty strongly in favor of opening schools. This is a huge issue. I think one thing that you're hearing a lot of people say, and I think I agree with this, is it really we need to be very carefully attuned to what's going on in the surrounding community. You know, if we're in an area of active transmission, really it's largely outside of New York right now, opening the schools doesn't make sense. If we are in an area where the community has been able to control transmission at large, then I think we can look towards safely reopening schools. I think what was just mentioned is really important. Protecting teachers is paramount. Most guidances that are being issued from various authorities are providing for teachers wearing masks. That's very important. And for older children that can tolerate that, masks and distancing are really important. So I think it's something we need to you know, society needs its schools open, and we need to do so in the safest way possible.
Dr. Yeager.
Yeah, I second everything that Dr. Rosenberg mentioned. It's a necessity that schools, I think, need to be open for children and colleges as well. And there's a lot of, I've been involved in a lot of discussions in my own college these past few months, trying to figure out how to open safely, to keep education, to offer education that is to the level students are expecting, both regular schools and college, and making sure that's done in a safe manner. So it's providing masks, maintaining distancing. And it's not an easy thing to prepare. I mean, there's a lot of thought that has to go into, you know, just our college, but I can imagine a whole school system down in like New York City and in localities. And as Dr. Rosenberg mentioned, it's going to be different from state to state. It's based on the local community and what's happening outside of that, because students aren't obviously going to be inside the classroom 24 hours a day. They're going out, coming back in. There's some fortunate, it seems, data that it seems that most of the transmission is adult to children. So for some ages, it seems like the ability of small children to pass the virus is a lot less, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, than the other way around. So there's, in some cases, maybe the risk is not as great as first initially thought.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Nina in East Hoosick. Hello, Nina.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'd like to know very specifically what research has been done, if any, about the transmissibility of COVID-19 through water. I have held off on doing my lake swimming this year. I'm not talking about how close you are to someone on the beach. I'm talking about how you might or might not get the virus when you're in the water with other people, not so much up close to them, you know, assuming that I would stay, you know, a good distance away, much more really than 6 feet, and I'd go into another part of the lake. But still, I would be passing through where people have been swimming, breathing, you know, face in water. Of course, your whole body is immersed in this element. So I've been very concerned about that, and I'd like to know what research, as I said, if any, has been done about is it safe to swim in lakes or not, and in passing in the ocean, but that's not as important as focusing on the lakes. So thank you.
Okay. Who wants to go with that one?
Well, I'm happy to comment first from the epidemiologic perspective.
Sure.
Yeah. Hi. I think water exposure is considered quite low risk. And Dr. Yeager can talk about sort of the virological reasons and why the virus doesn't survive to an infectious level that well in water. But I think that's considered a very low risk activity.
Dr. Yeager.
And that's even if you have your like face water.
Say it again, Nina.
Hello?
Say it again.
Yeah, I said that's right. Is that, I mean, like doing the Australian crawl and your face is in the water. That's okay?
I agree that the likelihood of the virus being passed from first person to water is quite low. So first there's the dilution aspect of it, and you're gonna be in a large body of water, presumably. And also, most importantly, the virus itself is pretty fragile. It's not meant to be a waterborne virus like some other viruses, like polio, for example, that it's a much hardier virus. So no studies have been done conclusively to look at the viability of this virus in ocean water. But compared to what's known about other viruses similar to this, it's likely not going to survive very long outside. It wants to get right back in the body. So I think it's relatively safe. Again, compared to if you are breathing in, again, respiratory is still going to be the main route that this virus is passed. There's been some studies where the virus has been found like in sewage, but it's based on the RNA. And I think the other thing that we talked about early on in the show was the aerosol thing has been a challenge. As Dr. Rosenberg mentioned, the studies is quite challenging. You can find virus by using molecular techniques, but it does not mean the virus is alive. So you might find some results out there that suggest viral RNA is found, but that does not equate to infectious virus. So long answer to a short question, I think that activity is very safe, particularly outdoors.
Nina, thanks a lot for the call. We're joined today by Dr. Eli Rosenberg and Dr. Eric Yeager, and we talk coronavirus today on this Medical Monday. 800-348-2551, the number. Jim in Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Jim.
How can you tell a naturally occurring virus from one that has been created by CRISPR or some other genetic modification? And what about it invading the endothelial cells?
Hmm.
I can take a stab at that one. So thanks, Jim, for your question. So what's clear with a lot of techniques we have now is we can do genetic sequencing. So we can see what blueprint makes up the virus. And each virus has a particular series of letters that make up the blueprint. So we can determine where the virus originated from. So the current virus, SARS-CoV-2, has the letters that make it part of that particular viral family. If the virus was made artificially, the idea would be that it would contain other pieces of other viruses to allow the virus what to do. And this virus is most closely related to a virus found in bats, and it evolved to attach to the cells that line our airways, and it can enter our cells quite readily. So there are mainly genetic techniques can be used to determine the origin of the virus. And that's actually very important for some of the epidemiology that maybe Dr. Rosenberg can comment on, is that it allows us to track, like it's almost like a fingerprint, how the virus has gone through the population from parts of Asia, Europe, and now North America.
All right, Dr. Rosenberg.
That's right. I think that really covered covered it quite well. And I'll just say that, right, that the sequencing technology that was just referenced really lets us understand how this moves through the population. If people have been watching the governor, he during his daily briefings, when the results came out that a lot of the New York infections had originated in Europe, that was something that he really emphasized and really tried, I think, sort of to help remove some of the geopolitics that have been injected into this epidemic. That this is not a Chinese virus that's come to New York. That in fact. A lot of the transmission originated from strains with those sequences that were just referenced that came from Europe, and that this has really been moving around the globe for some months in different ways. And that technology that lets us trace it all the way back to bats also lets us understand which populations are being affected and in which ways.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eli Rosenberg and Dr. Eric Yeager join us today. Bill is in Canajoharie. Bill.
Hi. Thank you. There are reports that a Korean guy got reinfected in 6 months, and in China, studies on monkeys were able to be shown to be reinfected in 28 days. What does the reinfection time say about the prospects of herd immunity or developing a need for repeat inoculations?
Let's go with Dr. Rosenberg first.
I think this is a really important question, one where really the understanding is still evolving in humans. So I'd say to be very careful in jumping from those other primate studies into humans. And I'll say it's tricky in many, many ways to understand. First of all, the immune system is complicated and has many components. So antibodies, which we hear a lot about, are just one component of our body's larger immune response. I think the other thing with some of the data that we're seeing in humans from countries that were affected first, South Korea was just mentioned, that it's very can become very difficult to establish what's a second infection versus a first infection that really lingered for some time or is sort of intermittent. And I think our ability to measure that is getting better, but we don't have really large-scale studies to look at many people to really ascertain what's reinfection versus new infection. But I'll say this is an area that lots of people are working on here in New York. This is an area that several groups are working on, and I think it's something we need to pay attention to, but the jury is still out on sort of the duration of immune protection.
Well, how long will it take for the jury to be in?
That's a great question. I think in the next several months give it a few months where I think we'll have enough time elapsed since areas that were affected between January and March for those studies to come in. We need to have, I'd say, a good 4 to 6 months at least of time has to elapse for us to get enough confidence that we have what looks to be a medium to long term immune protection.
Somebody said, and I'm not sure who it was, that in this pandemic, time is both expanded and contracted, depending on what day and at what time of day. Eric, you mentioned earlier the rapid pace of the vaccine research. In your estimation, is it too fast?
I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. I think we're fortunate that, I think I may have talked in the past about other pandemics like 1918 compared to this one. I think we're in a vastly different situation. We have so many scientific advances and technological advances that we can produce these vaccines, but there still has to be a measure of caution in doing things the right way. And normally, science, I think it can be frustrating to some people on the outside that science is a very methodical, slow process, and it needs to be tested and retested to make sure that we're confident of the answer we have. So I think in some cases, urgency versus science kind of conflict. So I think the safety, as I mentioned, it's still part of it. I listened to some webinars that the CDC was holding last week, and there's still, you know, there are groups of people that their livelihood is dependent upon making sure vaccines are produced and produced safely. And the last thing we want to do is to put out a vaccine that is going to lead to some ill effects and then turn people away from not only this vaccine but other vaccines, and then we'll have a larger public health issue. The vaccines that have been tested, I think, back to the previous question, that was somewhat in my mind a benefit is that some of these vaccines appear to generate immunity that seems to be better than natural immunity. So they're comparing convalescent serum, the antibody responses in people that recovered from a natural infection versus some of the individuals that volunteered for these vaccine trials. That the immune response looks a bit more robust. And the hope, as Dr. Rosenberg mentioned, it's going to take time, you know, and people, unfortunately, when we say time, it's going to be end of the year, perhaps, you know, in spring. We'll know what that means. We still don't know a lot of information about what is protection against this virus. So we call it the immune correlates of protection. Antibody certainly plays a role, but there's a large role for T cells and other immune cells that we're just starting to learn.
Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today. Also, Dr. Eli Rosenberg, as we talk coronavirus. And let's grab one more call before the next break. Robert in Red Hook. Robert, you're on.
Hi, thank you for your program. I was wondering if gargling with your average mouthwash or salt water has any benefit. And I had two other questions. The vaccine, if it's developed and successful, how concerned are the doctors with a large part of the American population refusing to take any kind of vaccine? And how would you grade our country so far? I read so many other countries doing so much better. Those are my three points.
Okay. Who wants it? All right. Hearing nothing. All right. Dr. Rosenberg.
Sure. So I'll come in on the gargling part. I'm not a physician, so you can talk to your personal physician about that, but I would say that is not a recommended strategy. This is a respiratory disease, and that would not, from my understanding of things, but that would not protect your respiratory tract whatsoever. So I would recommend to really follow the more standard advice of wearing a mask when in public, keeping distance really outside the home. That's really the most important, some of the most important protective measures you can take in addition to hand washing. And just to take a stab at the question around vaccine refusal, that is absolutely critical. Right, a vaccine is both a measure of personal protection, but it's truly a social contract, right, that through many people taking this vaccine, we can protect society at large, the concept of herd immunity. And we all need to be really on board and trusting of science, trusting of medicine, trusting of the government. And these are challenging days for that kind of trust. And we really must work at all levels to build that trust so that when a vaccine is available, there will be widespread adoption.
All right, let's take a quick break. Dr. Eli Rosenberg joins us, Dr. Eric Yeager as well. Our number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551, the number. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Eli Rosenberg and Dr. Eric Yeager join us today. And a few emails here, docs, and then we'll move on. This one's from Carol in Olive Bridge. I like this one. Our supermarkets have all had large arrows put on the floors of their aisles, making them one-way passages. Is there any real scientific justification for this? It's quite a nuisance, and half the shoppers ignore the arrows anyway, entering from whichever direction they want. I have seen that, and I can attest to that. All right, who wants this one?
I can start. But first, I just wanted to back up real quick about the vaccine question. I think Dr. Rosenberg said it eloquently, that vaccines are a social contract, are very important. And it's very important for this fall for people to get a flu vaccine when it comes out. The use of the flu vaccine is low compared to some other countries, and I really just want to use this opportunity to really stress for people to please get your flu vaccine. We really worry about co-infections or having two potential viruses causing a lot of trouble in hospitals, so please get your flu shot. Mm-hmm. Okay. With the arrows, I agree. The arrows are a bit of a frustration. I think it's really just trying to have predictable traffic patterns to limit person-to-person contact.
Yeah.
I don't know personally of any data that, you know, suggests that an arrow or a certain color arrow or an enter-exit sign is that. Really, as I mentioned, gets into contact time of individuals and density of places. So if you can keep people moving along, you keep people from stopping and congregating.
Dr. Rosenberg.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. I think it's truly, even though I think everyone knows it's not going to be, we're not going to have 100% compliance with those arrows, it's truly about reducing density, right? That you know, that we don't want people sort of coming across ways slowly down an aisle, staring at the chickpeas. That we really want to keep people moving along. Those, you know, the data show that probably the transient encounters that we have in the supermarket are very low risk, but it's truly that lingering that's the challenge. And so this is really a structural attempt to reduce that.
You know, I was in the store. I shop for my family mostly, and I saw an older lady just roundly castigating this big young guy, saying, "You're going the wrong way. Turn around." Well, the guy did it. I was really impressed.
Yeah.
This email came in from Mark. Mark says, COVID-19 is getting all the attention these days, and rightfully so. Because of this, it seems like no one is thinking about other medical conditions. What if a person needs to go to the hospital for other services? Should we be afraid and or delay these services until the virus is under control?
So I'll take a first swing at this one. I think this the thinking around this has evolved, right? Early on, there was a real hesitancy to have people coming into healthcare facilities for really non-essential reasons, and we can go into the history of all that. I feel like the pendulum has swung the other way. There's a real human cost to delaying surgeries and essential procedures, where people who are having pain or acute situations and not coming into the doctor, those can become fatal events. So we're seeing evidence accrue that there's been an excess of mortality from non-COVID conditions during this period. And so I think healthcare settings are really quite safe right now. Many protocols are in place to make them very, very safe environments. And if people have a real reason to seek healthcare, be it in an outpatient setting or an emergency department or what have you, please take care of yourself.
Eric.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's definitely a different situation, especially in New York now, than when it was in the beginning of the pandemic. That offices are, by and large, safe. We have a better sense of what a safe environment is. And there's been vast advances in telemedicine. So a lot of my colleagues and some of my family members have used telemedicine, so you can get some aspect of care at home. But definitely, I would agree. Please don't disregard certain health, your own health, out of certain precautions. I mean, I think there's some safety. Those places are safe to go to now.
All right, two more emails, and then we'll get back to the phones till the end of the show. This one's from John. What measures can we take to safely quarantine in the same household for the required 2 weeks with someone traveling back from Europe? And, Eric, that's one that you and I have talked about on every show that we've
certainly
done.
Yeah, it's kind of what we've – it's been the – from the information we've had in the beginning, it's really the hand hygiene, face coverings, limiting your exposure to the person, which admittedly is quite challenging. We're telling people to do it like in a workplace or in a other setting. Now you're doing it in a home setting where the space is really your how can you avoid a person? So really, I've read different situations where people, you know, kind of confine themselves to a room and try to pass off. And you don't want to kind of walk the person away and forget they're there. But really to just be mindful of the person and monitor yourself for any symptoms. And that's something that I think that's had evolved since the beginning, is we have a better sense now for what could be symptoms. And the list continues to grow. And it does get a somewhat, almost every symptom will respond, it seems like sometimes. But there are some clear symptoms that happen in a number of cases. So that and now the accessibility for testing. So I think there are far better ways to manage being able to be with someone if they're isolating or quarantining, and to make sure that you yourself are safe in that situation.
All right, Dr. Rosenberg, and then we'll do the last email.
Yeah, I fully agree with everything that's said, and I'll just add that both the New York State Department of Health and the CDC have on their websites guides to home quarantining, where you can find really a lot of what was just said summarized, and then other ideas and tips for getting through that period safely.
Okay, this one is from Maya. Maya writes, my grandmother, who is now president of Rotary in Ulster County, acquired polio from a public pool in Greene County in the 1930s. Please use caution when telling people water is safe, especially if immunocompromised. Very misleading information just now. There's no research regarding COVID-19 in water, so please don't pretend like there is. I'll let you guys respond to that one, and then we'll hit the phones.
Not to downplay, we don't know anything about this virus, but polio and SARS-CoV-2 are different viruses. The polio virus is a naked virus that's much more stable in water. And not to downplay the severe disease that caused in the 1900s and 1950s and the lines of people getting a vaccine. So I don't want to downplay that disease as well. But in terms of what we know about this disease being spread in terms of risk, as Dr. Rosenberg mentioned, it's what's the overall risk? And it's not 0% for water, but it's not, 100% either. So respiratory transmission is the main way this virus is being passed. So water, I think, is still a safe place for a person to be.
Eli.
Yeah, I'll agree with that fully. I think there's really been there really has been no definitive linkage to waterborne transmission of this virus. As was mentioned before, there's been detection studies, particularly in wastewater, where components of the virus have been detected, which tells us about population surveillance. But there's really truly no demonstrated risk to date. From water.
Let's go back to the phones and Michael in Chicopee. Michael, you're on.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good.
My question is a two-parter. My wife has an immune deficiency, and she has to have weekly infusions to up her IgG and IgAs. And she's hasn't left the house. We pick up everything when we shop. I haven't gone into any buildings. I'm also a soccer official, and there are games being posted, and she's afraid that I might get it wearing a mask on the field during a soccer game, and I don't know how viable that is, but I certainly don't want to be the one to come home and give her the virus.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think, certainly there's, we get to the question of risk again. So the outdoors, I'm assuming it's an outdoor soccer game. But sports are still kind of an unknown, and our college is kind of struggling with that as to how safe are sports. There's been some studies looking at respiration rates and running and biking, as I mentioned in previous shows. So there's thought to be an increased respiration, and there were some cases in Korea in an enclosed gym where a person was able to spread it. So there is a potential that, close contact, increased respiration rates. Again, it's mitigated by being outdoors. Presumably you're wearing a mask. So it's basically your level of comfort and what precautions the team is taking on the field.
Dr. Rosenberg.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I think having the sporting activities take place outside is important. And as an official, if it's as much distance as you can keep would be wise. I think the other thing is I'm not sure what your team or league is doing, but it may be indicated and or a good idea just personally to get yourself tested on some frequency. As we know, many occupational settings around the state are the employees are getting tested weekly, biweekly, and so forth because they're a higher exposure group. And so, if that makes sense for you, getting tested on some frequency could provide that extra level of security.
Dr. Rosenberg, you mentioned earlier in the program that these studies take time. But what have we learned, even if inconclusive, regarding the rate of transmission for those doing any outside activities?
That's a good question. I can't summarize all of that, all the literature on that quickly. I think what we know is it's certainly less, but still possible. It's not like there's zero transmission, and we can't speak about it as confidently as we just spoke about acquiring virus from the water. I think it is certainly a possibility in crowded outdoor settings, and there's definitely been evidence of that. I think, but in those outdoor settings, wearing a mask, wearing and keeping distance is important. This has come come up, as I'm sure many listeners are aware, with respect to the various protests over the past weeks and months, where there haven't necessarily been strong linkages to transmission in those settings. But again, I think mask wearing is an important add-on when spending time outside.
All right, let's go to Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Thank you. Greetings to all, and thank you, doctors. You've been giving me great information since the middle of March. Thank you. First, a witness statement. I'm one of those vaccine-resistant people. You there?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Good. I heard a beep. I will be accepting the flu vaccine this year just because. So from a vaccine-resistant person, I'm taking the vaccine for anybody who needs to hear that.
Okay.
Now, my question, especially regards aerosol versus droplets, I am a choral singer. I sing harmony music, especially sacred music, in choir settings. And I know that that's been, there were some choir outbreaks. Any new news?
I think from that initial finding with the outbreak in Washington State, and it was linked to a 2.5-hour choral session. So it does seem, you know, there's some observation on the anecdotal evidence that loud speaking or singing has a propensity to propel droplets farther, and that could lead to an increased risk for infection.
Yeah, and I'll say there has been several studies from CDC just on this. There was in the CDC's weekly publication a big report on an outbreak in a choir setting where many people were infected. And there was another one on there's been other studies of religious settings. So I would say that choir singing is actually considered a pretty high-risk activity. I believe that the current state guidelines around religious settings from the State Department of Health do really advise against singing in close proximity, and they have extra restrictions above and beyond wear a mask and 6 feet and all of that for singing.
Right.
Irrespective of the droplet versus aerosol debate, we know that singing really just involves putting out a lot of material from your body into the air, and we think that's a high-risk activity.
Right. I like the word you use, propulsion. It's what we're encouraged to use. So, yeah.
All right, Joan, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. Only a couple minutes left here. Lee in Walk Hill. Lee, you're on.
Hi. About 3 months ago, I noticed that I was starting to lose my sense of taste and smell, and I've been more tired and less wind when I bicycle and so on. I tested negative once for antibodies, and I was wondering if there was any way to improve my sense of taste and smell or what approach I would like it back. I would like to enjoy food again.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Eli.
Sure.
I'll just jump in and say I presume that you've been in contact with your primary care provider on this. I think that's obviously very important to be in close contact with your doctor and talk about the options. I'll say from a diagnostic perspective, the antibody test tells you about a few weeks ago. So if you had these symptoms more recently, that there's other tests available, which are the RNA tests, the diagnostic tests, and those are probably the ones that you should be seeking. Now, again, do this all in consultation with your physician. But the other test would really tell you about the more recent time period.
Eric.
Okay, and any treatment or anything I can do to improve my sense of taste and smell? Anything?
Yeah, I'll say discuss that with your physician. I don't do treatments.
Okay.
Okay. I've only read that it can take. Unfortunately, I think, you know, we don't know exactly why the virus does this when people are, you know. As Dr. Rosenberg said, you know, hopefully this is not something that happened recently, and you really consult your clinician to make sure you're not currently infected with the virus. If it's weeks ago, the antibody test will potentially, but not in all people, will show a response. But in terms of the sense of smell and taste, I've just read some studies that, again, some people it comes back within a few weeks and some people a few months. And there might be, if you go to your nose and throat doctor, there might be something they can do to hopefully kind of expedite the process.
All right, we only have about 30 seconds left here, guys. When you hear Count Basie tinkle the ivories, that means we're almost done. Let's go to Pamela and Troy. Pamela, it has to be very quick.
Good, Okay, two quick questions. One, I was tested in June for antibodies, and I haven't gotten the results. When I looked over the card they gave me, there was no contact information for how to follow up with them. And secondly, I was in New York City overnight in January, had a cold with a very, very bad cough a week later. And so I'm curious as to whether I might have had a mild case of it then.
Okay.
And how long the antibodies would last from the end of January
All
to
right.
June.
Well, we're almost out of time, so let's go with Dr. Yeager first.
So unfortunately, it would make it somewhat maddening is that antibodies do not, not all people produce antibodies. So a negative test doesn't mean that you are exposed, unfortunately. So you may not get the answer.
Okay. And Eli, you want to add something there and then we have to go.
Sure. I'll just comment that the earliest data that we have from New York City is that there was virus in early to mid-February. There's been no evidence yet of transmission in January. Not to say it's impossible, but less likely than, let's say, March.
Hey, guys, we're done. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here, Dr. Eric Yeager and Dr. Eli Rosenberg. Support comes from Dr. John Shin, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com for details. Thanks again to Dr. Yeager and Dr. Rosenberg for being here. Very informative program. And those guys, they're pretty busy, so we appreciate them giving us an hour here on the radio. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Kayleen White took the calls. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Rich Guthrie is here. It's Birds. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.